Why don't we go ahead and get started? This is our third installment now of the South Asia seminar for this year. And for the first half of the year, we've been having scholars of Indian philosophy. Today we have Mark Sivertz with us from Illinois State University in Normal, Illinois. Just drove up this morning from there. And Professor Sivertz has an interesting and unusual background, given the direction his career has taken. I remember on first learning it, being astonished to hear that he'd done his PhD dissertation on Nagarjuna and Nishida Kitaro in the philosophy department at Yale. But that's surprising mostly because of how clearly his work, his published work since then, has been in the idiom of analytic philosophy. Professor Sivertz's most recent book is Personal Identity and Buddhist Philosophy, Empty Persons, which was supposed to be the main title, right? The subtitle sounds like a main title. It was an editorial decision. Which is a book I would strongly recommend everybody as an especially interesting and lucid treatment of the issues of personal identity in Buddhist philosophy, and of a certain way of engaging them. It's a book that is not particularly Indological. It's really informed by the Indian arguments and an attempt to think creatively in the idiom of analytic philosophy from the perspective of those arguments, and an unusually successful attempt to do that, I think. And he's going to talk to us today about some issues at least overlapping with those kinds of things, in particular the question of compatibilism as something that Buddhist philosophy might have something to say about.
So. Thanks. Thanks for the kind words, Dan. When Dan, you first invited me up, you said something about wanting speakers to be reflective about the kinds of things that we do with these texts. And as you just said, I teach in a philosophy department. I'm trained in both the Indian classical Indian philosophical tradition and in analytic philosophy, and I teach both kinds of philosophy. And what I try to do in my own work is create a conversation between those two traditions. It's something that's hard to do. I know I have miserably failed on many occasions in the past. So you want to know what I now renounce, what I now retract. I can give you a list afterwards, anyone who's interested. But sometimes I think it does work, or it can work, or at least I think it's something that's worth trying to do. And the reason I think it's important to do is it's a way of keeping both traditions alive and on their toes. They're both trying to do similar sorts of things. They're using similar sorts of methodologies, like the methodology of argumentation, conceptual analysis, and they're trying to solve similar sorts of problems. But they are independent traditions, and so at least occasionally they will come up with, each tradition will come up with solutions to a given problem that you don't find on the other side of that divide. And so sometimes it can be useful to bring insights from one tradition to bear on the other. Of course, that also involves bringing the two into a full-fledged dialogue, and that often involves some real stretching. And sometimes when I present what I've been thinking about to an audience like you all, who are trained in matters Indological, I get some resistance, and there's a little touch of hostility in the air, because I seem to be doing things to the text that those of us who have our feet firmly planted in Indology find problematic. That's something that I'm alive to as well from time to time, and sometimes I lose sight of that. So I think it's interesting to reflect on those matters, but we can't really reflect on them until we actually sit down and try to do such a project and see what happens. So that's what I want to do today. I want to talk about what I'm now calling Buddhist paleocompatibilism. Okay, obviously terminology here is, you know, I'm thinking about, you've got in politics, you've got the conservatives, and then you've got the neoconservatives, and then you've got the paleoconservatives. Well, that's where terminology comes from. Similarly, in the debate over freedom and determinism, you have people who can be classified as classical compatibilists. But then in the last 20, 25 years or so, there's been a huge outpouring of work among people who are extending the basic compatibilist idea but doing it in new and interesting ways. They're typically known as neocompatibilists. Well, I want to identify a position I will call paleocompatibilism, and I think it's something that we can meaningfully attribute to certain Buddhists. In fact, most of the Buddhists in the Indian tradition, I think, could be fit under that label. But let me say a word first of all about, okay, what are we talking about? Talk about compatibilism. Those of us who haven't studied Western philosophy formally, or at least haven't done so in many years, quick rehearsal of the debate. Okay, compatibilism is the view that freedom and determinism, that is causal determinism, every event is caused by some antecedent event, are compatible. Okay. So if we live in a deterministic world, that is no obstacle to our occasionally acting in a way that could be described as free. Okay. Now, the language that's often used here is the language of free will. We say persons have free will. But that term is actually a debated term, because that's a term that's more likely to be used by an incompatibilist. Someone who says that freedom is incompatible with determinism. If determinism is true, then we don't have what these people would call free will. The compatibilist says, no, you'd best describe it not as free will, but the question isn't, do persons have a will that is free? The question is, rather, are persons free to do their will? So, we need neutral terminology here between the two sides of the debate. The neutral terminology is, let's use the term freedom, but we understand freedom to mean the kind of property that is required in order for someone to be held responsible for their action. To say an action is free is to say that the agent is responsible for that action. That is deserving of praise if it's a good one, blame if it's a bad or evil one. Okay, so that's the terminology that gets used. That's the neutral term. Freedom of the responsibility entailing sort. Okay, so you've got compatibilists who say, yeah, they're compatible, and then you got incompatibilists. Now, there are two kinds of incompatibilists. The so-called hard determinists who say, freedom and determinism are incompatible. We do live in a deterministic world, so therefore we do not have freedom. Okay? But then you've got the so-called libertarians, and this is a small L. We're not talking about the Libertarian Party here. The libertarians who hold that freedom and determinism are incompatible, but we do have what they call free will. We are free. And so there are certain things that happen in the world that are not causally determined, namely what they call freely chosen, free choices, free willings. Okay? So that's the landscape. Now, the freedom determinism debate is actually something that's relatively recent in the history of Western philosophy. You don't find this debate among the classical philosophers, you don't find this debate among the medievals. You only find it beginning in the 17th century with Descartes. It's a modern debate. And it might be interesting to think about why that might be, what sort of historical conditions might have given rise to this debate. But in any event, one more historical point. I don't know of any Indian text that raises this debate. I don't know of any Indian text where the question is raised, is determinism compatible with freedom, with the responsibility entailing sort of freedom? nonetheless, what I want to claim is that, okay, someone cannot actually be a compatibilist unless there are incompatibilists that they're talking to. To be a compatibilist is to make this claim that freedom and determinism are in fact compatible. Why would anyone say that unless there were other people saying no, they're not? Raising this question, how could anyone possibly be free? Given if you're right and everything is causally determined, how could anyone be free? It's only in that dialogic context that one can actually be a compatibilist. What I'm calling paleocompatibilism, though, is a view about the nature of persons that gives us resources, now that we are in this debate, to answer incompatibilists. Okay, so paleocompatibilism is a view of persons and their actions and what's required for desert and responsibility that contains within it the resources whereby, once the issue of are the two compatible gets raised, allows one to formulate some sort of compatibilist answer. Okay, that's what I mean by paleocompatibilism. I want to claim that the Buddhist reductionist view of persons, which is basically the view that's articulated in early Buddhism and in Abhidharma, that view can be thought of as paleocompatibilist. I would actually be tempted to say that Aristotle is also a paleocompatibilist, but I'm not going to push that one because I'm not a classicist. I don't know Aristotle well enough. But in any event, I do want to make this claim about early Buddhist and Abhidharma accounts of the person. This is a kind of paleocompatibilism. Now, this is a view that I actually formulated many years ago, something I published sometime in the mid to late 80s, where what I was doing was looking at Melinda Panha and Visuddhimagga, and I thought I saw in their resources that allowed for an interestingly different approach to compatibilism. Here's the basic story. Okay. First of all, the Buddhist reductionist view of persons. What do we mean by that? Well, most of us already know that story. It's the Buddhist doctrine of non-self. Look at the question is, what is the word I the name of? What does the word I refer to? Two possible answers. One is a self, that is that one part of the person, that one part of the psychophysical complex that is the essence of the psychophysical complex, that part that endures as long as the person endures. There is no such thing as that. Okay, that's the first part of the Buddhist doctrine of non-self. The second part, and this is the important part, I think, is that the word I is a convenient designator for a complex causal series, that is, the psychophysical complex as a whole. It's a convenient designator for that whole. It consists of a set of skandhas, a set of psychophysical elements existing at one time, going out of existence but causing a successor set of psychophysical elements to come into existence, etc., etc., etc. A causal series of sets of psychophysical elements. Okay. The word I is a convenient designator for that. Now, to call it a convenient designator is to say that, strictly speaking, there is no such thing as that causal series. What do exist are the individual elements in that series. None of them is permanent. Each of them exists only for a while, goes out of existence, but then causes some successor element to come into existence. So there is no individual element that is the person. That's the part, that's the non-self. There is no self part, the first part. But there is also no such thing as the whole existing over and above the parts. And this is where the analogy of the chariot comes in. Because what is a chariot? It's a bunch of parts put together in a certain way. strictly speaking, there are just the parts and their relations to one another. We think there is this thing, the chariot, that has the parts as its parts only because we speak a language that elides that glosses over all the details. Why is that? Because it's useful. Okay, the word chariot is a convenient designator. It's a useful way of talking about all those parts when those parts are put together in a certain way. Okay. The word person functions in the same way. There is no whole, the person, and there is no part of that whole that is the person either, that is the I. That's the non-self part. We think there is an I because we forget that that word is just a useful way of talking about first these and then those and then those and then those and so on and so on. Okay? So it's our metaphysical confusion that leads us to believe that there is a me. And that, of course, sets the stage for suffering, for existential suffering, because I think there's a me, and so I think that I have this life, but then this life of mine is going to end someday, so what's the point, blah, 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 existential suffering. Okay. What's the solution to the problem of existential suffering? Answer, realize that we made a serious mistake when we took that word I to be more than just a useful way of talking about first these things and then those things and then those things. Okay? This is the basic Buddhist reductionist view. Persons are reducible to individual psychophysical elements with all sorts of complex causal relations. Okay, person is a useful fiction. Strictly speaking, there are no such things. It's nonetheless useful to talk as if there were, just as it's useful for us to talk as if there were chariots and cars and bicycles and buildings and so on. Okay. Okay. So that's the Buddhist reductionist part. Now that segues neatly into this semantic dualism part that's at the very bottom of the page. You might have heard me say just a moment ago, strictly speaking, there is no such thing as a person. It's useful for us to talk as if there were such things. Well, that useful way of talking is what makes up what Buddhists call conventional truth. Conventional truth consists in, well, basically how everyone talks ordinarily outside of philosophy seminars. It's the set of conventions that we collectively have found to be useful, given the facts, plus our own wants, needs, and interests. And that turns out to crucially involve our believing that wholes are real. Things that are made of parts are themselves real, like the chariot, and the car, and the bicycle, and the building, and the tree, and blah, blah, blah. And us, persons. Okay? Conventional truth is useful in part because it takes a whole bunch of parts that we don't have time and energy to list all of, and talking about all the complicated ways in which they're interrelated, gives us one word, a one-off device for referring to all those parts when those parts are so related. Given our wants, needs, and interests, the fact that our lives are short, we've only got so much time to say what we want to say, it's much more useful for us to be able to say chariot than to say this wheel connected to this axle, connected to that wheel, connected to this chariot body, blah, 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 blah. Okay? It's much more useful, more convenient. Nonetheless, that's not ultimately true. The ultimate truth only talks about the parts and their properties and their relations. So we've got two languages. We've got conventional discourse, which is everyday discourse and involves talking about wholes. And then we've got ultimate discourse. That's the philosophically rigorous discourse, where we're speaking strictly. And there we only talk about the parts and their properties and their relations. Okay. In Abhidharma, this is what you get when you speak the Dharma language. You speak only about the Dharmas and their properties and their relations. Okay. Because what are Dharmas? Those are partless parts. Those are things that cannot be broken down into smaller things in any way. Okay. But talking that way, most of the time, would just simply be impractical. Most of the time, we speak conventional truth. And conventional truth is, in fact, useful for us up to a point. The point where it stops being useful is where it has us believing that there really are persons, and there really is a me. And so I wind up believing that there is a me who has this life, but this life is going to end, and so sets the stage for existential suffering. Okay? So, ultimate truth is the cure to that. Seeing that our conventional discourse works up to a point, but past that point gives rise to suffering. But also then seeing that conventional truth works because, to the extent it does, because it's just a useful way of talking about what's really there, which we can capture in the ultimate truth. That's the cure. That's how we overcome suffering. We come to see that up to a point it's useful for us to think that there are cars and chariots and bicycles and rocks and trees. It's even useful up to a point for us to think that there are persons. However, we have to see that that's just a useful way of talking. Strictly speaking, there aren't. Strictly speaking, there is just this impersonal causal series of psychophysical elements, the skandhas. That's all there really is. And that's what explains the usefulness of our conventional discourse about persons. Okay, that's the basic strategy. Now, how does that help set the stage for resources for a compatibilist? Well, I don't know of any place where the freedom determinism issue gets raised in the Buddhist tradition. But there is something that's analogous in certain respects to that issue, which is the question that always gets asked of the Buddhist. Look, if you're right about persons, if you're right there is no self, there's just this causal series, then how can karma be just? Because look, how can the person who reaps the karmic fruit in the form of pleasure and pain, be the same person as the person who performed the action? Particularly when we're talking about the action being performed in one life and the fruit being reaped in another life. So obviously there's nothing that exists now in this life that's enjoying that pleasure or suffering that pain that was present in that past life when the action was done. So how can this pleasure or pain that I am now experiencing be something that I deserve if no part of this bunch of skandhas here was back there then when that action got performed? Standard objection to the Buddhist doctrine of non-self from the Tirthikas, from the Brahmanical philosophers. And the stock response that you get from Vasubandhu, you see it in Melinda Panha, you see it in Visuddhimagga, Buddhaghosa says the same thing. The stock response is this. To say that this, okay, where did this karmic fruit come from, this experience of pleasure or pain? Answer, you can trace that back through this causal series to the performance of this action in this past life. It is those skandhas earlier, those psychophysical elements earlier caused other ones, which caused other ones, which caused other ones, which caused other ones, which in turn caused these psychophysical elements that are now experiencing the pleasure or pain. Okay, pleasure or pain is among the elements in this collection of psychophysical elements. Okay. The claim, we agree with you Brahmanical philosophers who think that there is karma and karma represents a kind of cosmic justice in a way. You perform a good action, you will get a pleasant result. You perform an evil action, you'll get a bad result, a painful result. We agree with all that. And we say, okay, it's because of that. Right now I'm experiencing pain. Why is that? Because of this earlier action in some prior life that was evil. Okay? Now, how do we square that with our non-self thesis? Answer, the ultimate truth is this pain can be traced back through a causal series to a particular desire, a particular willing that led to a particular action that was, in fact, an evil action. Okay? The karmic causal laws dictate that when that desire, that willing, that chetana occurred, that volition, then there would eventually have to be an experience of pain. Okay? That's how the karmic causal laws work. And they work entirely impersonally. Okay? Nobody was out to do you any harm. That's just how the universe works. Okay? That's the ultimate truth. That ultimate truth can, however, be conventionally described as I performed that evil action, so I now experience this pain. It was I who did that action, so I now experience this pain. Why can it be described? Why can it be conventionally described that way? Answer, what do we mean by a person? Answer, a complex causal series of sets of skandhas, sets of psychophysical elements. That's exactly what we've got in this case. So we've got a person, that is a cause. Ultimately what we've got is a causal series of sets of skandhas, but conventionally we describe that with the single word person. We've got a person, conventionally described, who performed this action with this, out of this volition, and is now experiencing this painful fruit. Okay. So in other words, the ultimate truth, okay, back to the objection. How is this supposed to answer the objection? The objection was, if you're right, if there is no self, then karmic fruit can't be deserved. Why? Because all that's going on there is, you know, these elements back there, these elements up here, those elements are one set of elements, this is another set of elements, so how can this be the person who performed the action getting their just desserts? Well, the Buddhist response, you're putting together two different levels of description. You're running together the ultimate truth and the conventional truth. The ultimate truth is the causal story. The story about this volition causing certain later elements, which cause certain later elements, which cause certain later elements, until eventually you get to this feeling of pain as the final fruit. That's the ultimate truth. The conventional truth describes exactly the same phenomena, but describes it using this convenient word person, as one person who earlier did the action and now reaps the karmic fruit. You're running together those two different descriptions, but they're two separate descriptions of exactly the same thing. What we have done, in other words, is we've explained why it's useful for us to say a person who performs an evil action will eventually reap a painful fruit, a person who performs a good action will eventually reap a pleasurable fruit, why it's useful to say that even though, strictly speaking, there is no such thing as a person. All there is a causal series of impersonal psychophysical elements. What this suggests, okay, now, once again, if the Buddhists are any kind of compatibilist at all, they're paleo-compatibilists, because they didn't have any incompatibilists, I'm assuming. But this does suggest some resources that a compatibilist could use. They could say, look, you incompatibilists, you think freedom and determinism are incompatible. But now let's think about that. Determinism, what are you talking about there? You're talking about the, in the case of persons, you're talking about the causal relations between this psychophysical element and this other psychophysical element and this other psychophysical element. It's at the level of ultimate truth that determinism is true. But now, what about freedom? When we talk about freedom, what are we talking about? We're talking about persons. Freedom is a property that persons sometimes have. We ask, did this person do this freely? And remember that by freedom, we mean the responsibility entailing kind of freedom, the freedom that carries with it desert for reward or punishment, blame or praise. Okay? And blame and praise, what are they blame and praise of? Persons. So if it makes any sense at all to talk about freedom, it could only make sense at a level at which we can talk about persons. And what level is that? The conventional level. And guess what, folks? Conventional level and ultimate level are two distinct levels that cannot be mixed, that cannot be run together. When you do that, you always get into trouble. There's a relation between those two levels. The ultimate level describes how things really are apart from how we, what's useful for, what's a useful way for us to think about things. The conventional level describes how the world is in a way that is in person-sized chunks, a way that's useful, manageable for us with our tiny little minds and tiny, short little attention spans and so on. Okay? But you can't mix those two ways of talking. That's what I mean by semantic dualism. We've got two distinct languages here. Conventional language and ultimate language. Two distinct truth predicates. Conventional truth predicate and ultimate truth predicate. The conventional truth predicate only attaches to a discourse that talks about wholes, the big things. The ultimate discourse only attaches to a language that talks about the partless parts. When you try to say, you try to talk about the wholes and the parts in the same breath, you get into trouble. Because you're mixing two different languages, two different truth predicates. Okay? You can't say that, for instance, okay, the person is, I was caused to believe this and that. I was caused to want this and that. And that's what made me act in this way. When you talk that way, you're using the word person, so you're talking about a whole, like a chariot, but you're also bringing in the notion of my will or my belief or my desire being caused by something that happened before. When you talk about my beliefs and my desires, you're talking about the parts that make up the person. You're talking about psychophysical elements. But it's that, precisely that move that leads to incompatibilism. The incompatibilist says, well, if determinism is true, if it's true of us that everything about us is caused, then we are not free. Well, by everything about us being caused, they mean, for instance, my beliefs, my desires, my will, but those are parts. So they're talking about the person, the whole, and they're talking about the parts at the same time. Semantic dualism says you can't do that. You're mixing two different languages, and you get into trouble that way. So what this offers is resources for the compatibilist to answer the incompatibilist. When I wrote that article many years ago, I saw that as the basic move that was behind what Milinda Panha and Visuddhimagga are doing in answering the objection about karma and desert. Now, okay. Yeah, I've actually just about used up my time, so I don't really have much time to talk about Shantideva. But let me just say a few words about Shantideva. I published that article many years ago, then not too long ago, about 5-6 years ago, someone else published an article in the same journal basically saying, no, Siddharth's got it wrong, look at this passage in Shantideva. What Shantideva is doing in this part of chapter 6 of Bodhicharyavatara is, in fact, pledging allegiance to the hard determinist form of incompatibilism. What he's actually doing, and I think you can see why someone might think that. Okay. Now, this is from chapter 6, which is the chapter on kshanti, on developing patience or forbearance. Kshanti is the antidote to dvesha, to aversion, and aversion is one of the three kleshas. Why? Because it tends to perpetuate belief in a me. And to overcome suffering, you have to overcome the ignorance that makes us think there is a me. When we allow ourselves to become angry, then that perpetuates the belief in a me, whose, you know, dignity has been violated and so on. So if you want to overcome suffering, you need to develop patience or forbearance. And that's what chapter 6 is doing, is talking about the cultivation of kshanti. And here's a little exercise that Shantideva suggests we, the bodhisattva-to-be, practice. Think like this. There is no anger in me toward bile and the like, though they cause great pain. Why anger toward sentient beings? Their anger is also due to causes. Okay, I don't get angry when my pancreas produces a bunch of bile and that causes me gastric distress, gastric pain. Sure, it causes pain, but I know it's perfectly irrational for me to get angry at the bile or angry at the pancreas. It's not, you know, intentionally harming me. But why should I be any more, why is anger any more justifiable when it's directed at Dan, even though Dan did something to harm me, suppose? Okay? Like he wrote a review of my book that just basically tore it to shreds. Okay, suppose. Why should I get angry at him? Because strictly speaking, the anger that occurs in Dan, that caused Dan to do something that pained me, is likewise due to causes. Just like the bile that harmed me, that pained me, is due to causes, so the anger toward, directed at me in Dan was likewise due to causes. So if it's irrational for me to be angry at my pancreas, why is it rational for me to be angry at Dan? Now, you might wonder, is that really a good argument? But what Shantideva is doing here is he is invoking that reductionist view of persons. Strictly speaking, what are we talking about when we talk about Dan? We're just really talking about a causal series of impersonal elements. No different in kind than the pancreas, which released the bile that caused me the pain. So Dan's getting angry at me, writing a scathing review that made me feel, is just like my pancreas releasing all that bile. Okay, just as this pain arises unwished for, the pain due to the bile, so anger also arises unwished for due to causes. Dan didn't wish himself into the state of, I'm going to get angry at Sideritz, and then I'm going to write this scathing review of his book. Okay? A person does not intentionally get angry, having thought, I will be angry. Nor does anger arise with the intention to arise. It's not as if the anger itself thinks, I'm going to arise and make Dan behave in this way. Okay? It just simply happens in this purely mechanistic, deterministic way. That's all. Whatever transgressions and evil deeds of different sorts there are, all occur through the power of their causes. But no autonomous power exists. Nothing independent of those purely mechanistic events that make up the causal series. Okay? Now, he goes on with a couple more verses that basically show, even if you posited a self among all the elements that make up the so-called person, even if you did that, insofar as that self would have to be something that is eternal and therefore couldn't undergo any change, it couldn't do anything either. The only things that can do anything are these impermanent events, but none of those impermanent events could be the true me. So there is nothing in when I really think through my training as a good Buddhist and I reflect on the truth of non-self, I have to realize that, strictly speaking, it's irrational for me to be angry at Dan. Okay? What Shantideva is doing here, in other words, is recommending using the truth of non-self, this reductionist view of persons, as a way of overcoming anger. Anger is, strictly speaking, irrational. Okay? Now, this other person, Charles Goodman, looked at this and said, doesn't that show that the Buddhist position is really incompatibilist? In fact, it's a hard determinist incompatibilist position. Isn't Shantideva saying, really, strictly speaking, persons are not free? There is no such thing as free will. There's just these impersonal elements, one causing another, and there's no room in that picture for free will. And moreover, it's useful for us to realize that because then we can overcome our natural tendency to get angry. And overcoming anger is an important part of training toward being a bodhisattva, actually for being an arhat. You have to get rid of the three kleshas in order to attain enlightenment on the arhat's path. Okay? So, isn't that what the Buddhist position really must be? The hard determinist view that because everything is causally determined, including all the states of the so-called person, therefore there is no such thing as freedom. Okay? Now, my response to that. Look at the very last verse of the passage that I've given you. This is obviously not the end of the chapter, but this is the last verse of the part that I chose to translate. Objection. Prevention of anger is thus not appropriate. For who prevents what? Okay, here's what that amounts to. Suppose you're right in what you've just said, to the effect that, it's never appropriate to get angry at a person because, strictly speaking, there is no such thing as a person. There's just this relentless flow of these impersonal elements in a causal series. They're all causally determined. They only arise because something in the past happened, blah, 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 blah. Suppose that's true. Well, then in that case, you are advising me, you, Shantideva, are telling me, the aspirant to the Bodhisattva path, that I ought to prevent my anger. I should practice this form of meditation. I should cultivate Shanti. Why are you telling me that? What's the force of your saying, I ought to? What you're saying is, if I don't, there's something wrong in not doing so. It would be reprehensible on my part not to cultivate patience or forbearance. And when you say that, you are saying that I am the sort of being who can be held as either praiseworthy or blameworthy. I can be held responsible for my actions. But that means that I am free. Your advice wouldn't make any sense unless you thought of me as a person who, if I follow your advice, am praiseworthy. If I don't follow your advice, I'm blameworthy. I'm doing something dumb. I'm just setting myself up for more suffering. Okay? But then in that case, you must think there are persons. Okay? Shantideva sees this as an interesting and important objection to this advice he's just given. So he's aware of this. What's his reply? It, that is prevention, is taken to be appropriate with regard to dependent origination due to the cessation of suffering. Okay. Now, with regard to dependent origination, what he has in mind there is the 12-fold chain of dependent origination as taught by the Buddha. Okay. And what's that all about? That's the path. That's what we need to understand in order to overcome suffering. Okay. We need to understand why it is that suffering arises. Ultimately, it's because of ignorance. Okay. So the allusion here, in other words, is to the practice of the aspirant to nirvana, to enlightenment. He's saying prevention of anger is appropriate with regard to that goal. That is, in the context of someone who aspires to overcome suffering, it is useful for us to think of ourselves as persons who can be, who are deserving of praise and blame, who are responsible for what we do. In that context, it's useful. In other words, it's conventionally true that we are responsible for what we do. Why is it conventionally true? Because it's ultimately true that we quote-unquote, consist of this complex causal series of impersonal elements, which behave in such a way that it turns out you produce more pleasure than pain, more happiness and suffering, if those work in these ways. If they follow, for instance, Shantideva's advice. So it's useful for us to think of ourselves as persons who are free. Is it ultimately true? No. But does that mean it's ultimately true that we are not free? No, that's not ultimately true either. Because the word we doesn't mean anything at the level of ultimate truth. Why is that? Because we is just the plural of I, and what's I? That's the name of a person. What's a person? It's a whole. Ultimately, there are no wholes. But it's useful for us to think of certain wholes as themselves real things. And when we think of them in these ways, here's something else that is useful. If we think of them as systems that can be held responsible for their behavior, then, in fact, what do we get? We get, in the long run, more pleasure than pain, more happiness than suffering. And so it's conventionally true that we are persons. It's ultimately true that everything is causally determined. That's not conventionally true. because the part of the world that we're talking about when we talk about persons can't be said to be causally determined, because when you talk about that, then what you're really doing is trying to smuggle in talk about the parts of persons. And that's a no-no. You can't talk about the whole and its parts in the same breath. Okay? That's the basic idea. And that's what I call Buddhist paleocompatibilism. Shantideva himself isn't a compatibilist. He never addresses the question, are we free? He never talks about freedom in that sense, the sense in which, you know, that goes along with being deserving of praise and blame, reward and punishment. He never talks about freedom in that sense. But he does say things that I think, against the background of semantic dualism and Buddhist reductionism, and those are tools he does use throughout Bodhicaryavatara, against that background, can be turned into resources that constitute an interesting response to the challenge of the incompatibilist. Because here's what the incompatibilist says nowadays. This is the latest incompatibilist challenge. Look, suppose I, because Dan wrote that scathing review of my book, I pull out my pistol and I hold it to his head and I pull the trigger and I shoot him. Okay. Because I have not listened to Shantideva's advice. Suppose I do that. Okay. Now, we all want to say I'm responsible for doing what I did, and so I should be punished. Okay, I performed a blameworthy action, I deserve to be punished. When we say that, suppose we believe that everything about me is causally determined. Well, okay, for instance, the state of mind that I was in just before I pulled the trigger, involving various beliefs and various desires. Okay, suppose that I was perfectly well aware of what I was doing leading up to this. In fact, I've been thinking it all, you know, the 2.5 hours I was driving up from Bloomington Normal, I was going over in my head my plan for my great revenge. Okay? And, you know, I thought about, I'll probably wind up, well, I won't get fried because we don't do that in Illinois anymore, but chances are I'll spend a lot of time in prison. But I still am going to do it. I rationally reflected on everything, okay? It was my will that he die, okay? It wasn't just a flash in the pan anger. So it looks like, you know, I'm really responsible for what I did. I did it of my own free will, we would say. Well, says the incompatibilist, but look, how did you come to have the particular beliefs and desires, including the particular ability to reflect on your beliefs and desires that you have that led you to this deliberate action? Well, certain things happened to you earlier in your life that caused you to have those abilities. Okay? Now, suppose that you're having those states that led you to have these states were itself something that you endorsed, that you said, yeah, I like being this way. I know I could, you know, grow up to be someone who follows the crowd, but, you know, I like my Nietzsche, and so I'm going to, you know, I'm going to be Superman, whatever. And, you know, I like being that way, and that's what led me to being in the state I was in as I was driving up and reflecting on what I'm going to do tonight, et cetera, et cetera. Well, okay, but how did I wind up being that way? Well, presumably because of some way that I was even earlier in my life. Well, eventually, as we trace backwards, we're going to get to stuff that happened before I was born. And surely I'm not responsible for how things were before I was born. But if I'm not responsible for that, then I'm not responsible for what that led to. I'm not in turn responsible for what that led to, and so on, until we get to my pulling the trigger. So if determinism is true, then you can't hold me responsible for killing poor Dan. Okay? That's the incompatibilist challenge. It's basically the before I was born line. If determinism is true, then my decision and the action that flowed from that decision can be traced back to factors that were the way that they were before I was born. Surely I can't be held responsible for that, so I can't be held responsible for what has flown, what has flowed from that. Well, the Buddhist paleocompatibilist gives us a way of answering that challenge, which is, everything you say about the causal series is true, but that tells us absolutely nothing about whether I acted freely when I pulled the trigger. I did act freely when I pulled the trigger. Why? Because my pulling the trigger grew out of a set of mental events that I have myself endorsed. What caused those, when you start talking that way, you're talking ultimate truth. You're talking about the parts of the person. What we're interested in is the person. Did the person act freely? The answer is, well, did they think about it? Did they deliberate? Or was it rather that, you know, there's some tumor on Sidorits' brain that caused him to twitch, and for some reason there was a gun there, and, you know, he didn't even plan on there being a gun there, just, you know. Instead of that, it came from within me, the person. Okay? And that's the end of the story. That's the end of our investigation into whether I am responsible, whether I should be tried and convicted and sentenced to life in prison. And the answer in this case is yes. The question about the causal ancestry of my states, of my belief states, my volitional states, is irrelevant to that question, because that question, the question about the person, is conducted at the level of conventional truth. The question about the causal antecedents of my belief states is conducted at the ultimate level. And those two levels can't mix. Okay? That's how I see the Buddhist giving interesting new resources to the compatibilist. Okay? Well, I'm going to shut up now.